From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in March when the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative released a series of guidelines that will frame their work going forward. In other words, this was not the final blueprint on defeating poverty or addressing or alleviating it, but it was a specific look at community issues that must be addressed. And there were three main prongs: structural racism, trauma, and community building. Now, what exactly do they mean when they point to those issues? We're about to find out. And how are they going to connect agencies? If you've been following the work of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, you know that it involves grassroots organizations, neighborhood groups, political leaders, not-for-profits. I mean, there are so many people involved. How do you stay connected going forward and kind of stay cohesive on this? Let me go ahead and welcome my guests for the hour, and we'll be taking your questions as well. Dr. Leonard Brock is here, the director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Dr. Brock, nice to have you back here.
Thanks for having me.
Henry Fitz is here. He's the Director of Innovation for the City of Rochester's iTeam. Henry, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And LaShunda Leslie-Smith is here, the Executive Director at Connected Communities. LaShunda, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Dr. Brock, this March report is in some ways very specific and in some ways still kind of broad, but I wanted to start there and let our listeners know this isn't the sort of the final blueprint on beating poverty. What was the purpose of the March guidelines?
Yeah, those are a set of principles that we're looking to use to inform our practices and also to work throughout the broader community. When the work groups met the summer of 2015, there were some major barriers that continued to cut across each of the domain areas of housing, jobs, health, et cetera. And those three major barriers were structural racism, trauma, and community building. So they became design principles because what we said, as opposed to treating them as individual projects, those specific barriers actually is something that permeates throughout the entire areas by which we're looking to address with respects to reducing poverty. So neighborhoods that are confronted with these major challenges are also neighborhoods by which we have to look to address the issues of poverty in a much more meaningful, structural, and systemic way. And we know that we can't program our way out of poverty. So these are a set of guiding principles that we're using to inform the specific practices in the specific areas that we're looking to focus and target. But not just the anti-poverty initiative. These are also guiding principles and shared values that we hope that the broader community will be able to adopt and embrace and be able to respond.
Now, in other words, it sounds like you didn't go into the process a year ago and with the determination that structural racism, trauma, and community building are going to be the issues that you want to solve and how can the work groups help. You put the work groups together and those three kept coming up.
Yes, and there were 25 persons that participated in each work group. So there were 8 work groups and you have 200 persons, and then you have over 1,000 individuals that either informed the work by way of surveys, focus group interviews, etc. And those that came out of that work group process.
Okay. How have some of the some of the political leaders, there's so many involved in this process. Is everyone getting along? How's it going so far? I mean, this is not an easy job that you have.
It's not an easy job, but there's a significant amount of support and interest on behalf of the broader community. So we have a significant number of partners at the table. So is it an easy task? Absolutely not. And I would be remiss to say that this is something that's a walk in the park. But ultimately, it's what's necessary in order for us to move the needle. So everyone has, for the most part, no one has left the table. And we actually have a good problem, more so than, you know, people not leaving the table. We have more people running to the table. So the question becomes, how do we galvanize the support of the broader community? Because, again, even with those three principles, the goal is how do we ensure that everyone is able to understand what those principles are, how they can actually infuse those principles within their practices, and how they can work in partnership with us to do the work necessary to reduce poverty.
All right, listeners, if you want to check out these guidelines that were released in March, we'll post them. In fact, if you follow us on Twitter at Evan Dawson or our producer, Megan Mack, at MMacMedia, Megan and I will both post them on our Twitter feeds, and you can just click to it and link to it. It's easy to read. It's a lot of reading, but it's not overwhelming by any means. And you can see exactly what we're working through there. And I want to kind of divide the hour between talking about those guidelines and also talking about these partnerships that have to succeed if you're going to succeed, Dr. Brock, if, yes, if the initiative is going to succeed. So let's kind of go around the table and understand the relationships that are in this room right now. LaShunda Leslie-Smith is the executive director at Connected Communities. I suspect a lot of our listeners don't know what Connected Communities is, so let's start there.
Absolutely. I'm happy to tell them all about it. So Connected Communities is a nonprofit organization that is specific to serving and eliminating poverty and revitalizing the Beechwood and Emmon neighborhoods. Our focus, we have four different pillars which very, very closely align to our MAPI principles, and that includes mixed income and affordable housing, workforce and economic development, cradle to career educational pipeline. We're trying to ensure that people in that community can really rely on neighborhood schools, and then also health and wellness. The ultimate goal is to ensure that the people who live in that community, the residents of both Emma and Beechwood, can live, play, and work safely in their neighborhood.
Okay, and is this model going to grow and spread?
Well, we're focused right now on Emma and Beechwood.
Sure.
Again, I think, as you mentioned earlier, in order for our MAPI to be successful, it takes partnership.
When she says our MAPI, it's Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. You may hear that this hour. That's what our MAPI is.
It takes partnerships like this. And we've heard so many times that Rochester, A, has more nonprofits per capita than any city its size, that we are resource rich and results poor. We're no longer going to be siloed. I think it's very, very exciting to see the synergy amongst the people at the table and so many others. As Leonard has said, people are running to the table to ensure that we can do something about it. And the goal ultimately is, if we can be successful, when we are successful in Emma and Beechwood, that these efforts will be replicated in other parts of the city.
All right. So taking just pick one of them. Just take Beechwood, for example. What are some of the specific actions that you're already seeing taken to start addressing these issues?
Oh, absolutely. So I can talk a little bit about the Cradle to Career Educational Pipeline. We are really focused in on working with both Number 33 School as well as East High School. Currently, Number 33 School is the largest elementary school in the Rochester City School District, yet only about 15% of their student population live in the neighborhood. Well, there's a lot of research that show that neighborhood schools are effective at serving the community. Parents can walk to their students' school for parent-teacher conferences. They will know the students who are going to school with their kids. They will build relationships with the teachers. Generations of their students, their families will be going to those schools, etc. And it really strengthens the health and wellness of that community. So I have been in conversations with individuals at our Rochester City School District, with Dr. Larry Ellison, the principal there, with Dr. Nelms at East High School, and we're working very, very closely to create this educational pipeline to ensure that we can turn Number 33 School into a neighborhood school. That will take a long time. All of the work that we're talking about here around the table today will take a significant amount of time, but the ball is rolling and we're getting to work.
That is such an important point that LaShunda just made there, because whether it's those of us in the media or the community at large, we start asking for benchmarks, which I think are important, but I think overreacting to what happened in 6 months, what happened in a year. You know, you don't solve poverty in a year.
Absolutely.
But how, LaShunda, how? I don't think I've ever seen a single initiative that is really a 10 to 20 to 30 year build that involves so many agencies and so many different people. How do you hold it together for that long? I mean, it just seems like eventually there'll be new political leadership. Someone might come in with different ideas. We've talked about trying to fight obesity in this community. We have these big, long, overarching plans. It doesn't always work out that way.
Right.
What are your concerns there?
Well, I think more than my concerns, I think we should really look to what's evidence-based. We have to stop. Everyone has an ideal of how to solve poverty, and everyone thinks that their ideal is better than the next person's. But what we really need to look at is what are the numbers saying? So Connected Communities came about because we began looking at purpose-built communities. In Eastlake, the Eastlake community in Atlanta, they have a purpose-built community model that has been running for about 20 years now that have had significant success. So this was an area very similar to the Emma and Beechwood community, in which that it had high levels, high concentration of poverty, high crime, just a lot of the chronic issues that make neighborhoods suffer, they were experiencing. And they brought in these four pillars and created a neighborhood school. They revamped the housing stock, the existing housing stock, built some new housing stock, created health and wellness programs, access to transportation, brought in new jobs into the community. And people are currently, as we speak, able to live, work, and play safely in that neighborhood. So the way we attack it is I think I've heard Dr. Brock say often, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. So we're not going to solve this problem, as I mentioned, in a short period of time. You work on one thing, you get it done really well, and then you add the next thing.
Okay. And Dr. Brock, what I'm hearing from LaShonda is, you know, this is a small slice of our community, but instead of a poverty initiative that says it's sort of top-down, lawmakers kind of from on high, you guys all do this. There's a lot of grassroots involvement, at least from what I can see. And I imagine that's going to really be important here.
Absolutely. It cannot be a top-down approach. It cannot be led solely by institutional leaders. It has to be actually a merging of the two. A grassroots movement is only as effective as the supports and the resources that they could garner from institutional leadership. And institutional leadership cannot do much in the absence of that grassroots voice. So it truly has to be a partnership amongst the various different constituencies throughout the community. And we've learned from other communities like Newark, for in particular, when they had a top-down approach, when it was Mark from Facebook,
Zuckerberg,
and Chris Christie, and they had an institutional, they had a top-down approach, and there were $100 million, very similar to what we hear in Rochester.
For charter schools, yep.
Yeah, and it fell miserably. And one of the reasons, one of the learnings that came out of that particular process is that they did not engage the broader community. So that's why the guiding principles are very important, because it kind of speaks to that partnership. And the reason why it's sustainable is because those are values that will live beyond any political officer or even any community leader, any superintendent. Those are principles that we value as a community. So irrespective of the actual person, those are principles that we're trying to align everyone to.
Listeners, if you want to join the program with any comments or questions on the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative related to any of the issues you're hearing discussed this hour, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You've heard both Dr. Brock and LaShonda use the term evidence-based. Henry Fitz, to some degree, that's where you come in. You're the Director of Innovation for the City of Rochester's I-Team. That's something else listeners might not be familiar with. What's the I-Team?
Absolutely, yeah. I think we're going to be new to a lot of listeners. We're just over a year and a half old, and our new team that's been launched in City Hall. You can think of us like City Hall's Research and Development Department. We help research issues, strategies being done in other cities, help tailor those ones that might work for Rochester for our context, and help establish those around strong evaluation systems to make sure we can show our impact and measure success. And it's all about partnership, as these guys have said. We're working with both internal City Hall stakeholders as well as external partners to get things done.
Let me take our first phone call, because it goes to sort of data collection, things like that, that I think you'll be able to talk about, Dr. Brock, and then we'll kind of build on some of what Henry is explaining on their role. But it's Terry in the City of Rochester with a question on measuring progress. Go ahead, Terry.
It's actually not so much on measuring progress as keeping the community informed. I bought my house in the Emma District probably 13 years ago and just heard about the community group that's sort of been started up, well, not started up, to address the hillside purchase. But so, sorry, to get to the heart of the question, it's how do we keep informed on all these different things? I come home from work a lot, and I'll see a notice saying there's a meeting the following day, which unfortunately with that notice I can't make. Is there a central resource? Is there a Facebook page? Is there a community page? How do we actually stay in touch?
It's a great question, Terry. Thank you. Dr. Brock?
Yeah, so there's several ways by which we try to engage and inform the broader community. One, we host town hall meetings quite frequently. We also have the website endingpovertynow.org, by which we have a repository of information that comes out of the initiative.
Endingpovertynow.org.
Yes, endingpovertynow.org. In addition to that, we're also in the process, LaShonda and I, Henry, of organizing a community advisory council. The community advisory council will consist of resident leaders within those two neighborhoods, Emma and Beachwood, but also Market View and the broader community. And that will be an opportunity for us to explore other ways that we can inform the community that will actually be led by community residents. So there are the town hall meetings, There are the presentations that I do quite frequently. There are the website of endingpovertynow.org. There will be the Community Advisory Council, and there's also the neighborhood meetings that I know LaShonda attends and presents at, and Henry as well. And Henry, you also may want to talk about the survey that we just completed not too long ago. So there are a number of ways that we look to inform and engage the community.
Okay, what survey is he talking about, Henry?
Sure, absolutely. So we do a lot of data analysis using CitySource data and census data, but especially as we start to zero in on some target neighborhoods where we want to test some of our new strategies, it's important to really validate that data and gather new data to understand the experience of the citizens living there and their specific needs of that neighborhood. So in partnership with our MAPI neighborhood leaders and the Flower City AmeriCorps program, we designed and implemented a door-to-door survey for the pilot district in which we're going to be working. It's a statistically significant sample size. 441 surveys were completed door-to-door, and then an additional 167 were completed online and at neighborhood meetings. And this is with the goal to understand a little bit more about the demographics as well as what services and needs there are in the neighborhood and what neighborhood residents feel like could be valuable to help them attain economic mobility and help improve their neighborhood.
So that survey is going on now, or it's already been done?
We wrapped that up at the end of April, and we're currently doing analysis and compiling the data. That data is, we'll be sharing a report in the coming weeks, and you can look for that on our website. And we'll also be sharing the raw data for all of our partners to do their own analysis
if
they'd like.
What's one of the most valuable things you can gain from that kind of data, Dr. Brock?
Yes, the perspective of people in the community. What are the barriers that prevent people in poverty from being economically self-sufficient, or what are some of the barriers that allow the continual cycling in and out of poverty? So one of the things that will be important for us to know, we have an evidence-based project or model that we're looking to call Family Independence Initiative as a framework for the adult mentoring strategy that I'm going to talk about shortly. And the evidence is the use of internet and the use of laptops. But when we did the survey, what we discovered is, I want to say 70%+ has access to internet, but only 20% public internet. So what we've discovered is that mobile devices and cell phones is the best way by which a lot of the residents actually are able to take advantage of internet. So as opposed to saying, you know, you input information and data using a laptop, it gives us an opportunity to use mobile devices as the best way of engaging that community and being able to inform how we are able to collect data. So it gives us that neighborhood perspective, and also allows us to understand the neighborhood, because if you are looking to impose anything on any neighborhood, chances are you're not going to be successful. The only way this is going to work is working with the neighborhood, understanding the needs of the neighborhood, which the survey allows, but then also from that perspective, informing, engaging, and making sure that the neighborhood is part of every single part of the implementation process.
We're talking about the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. You're hearing the voice of Dr. Leonard Brock, the director of what they call RMAPI, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, and Henry Fitz, Director of Innovation for the City of Rochester I-Team, along with LaShonda Leslie-Smith, who's the Executive Director at Connected Communities. Listeners, if you want to call the program, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. What's too early to ask for results, Dr. Brock? Because we know right now is, but you know, this is maybe a 30-year plan, maybe a 15-year plan, but when can we start to expect to see something that would make us feel like by now we should be seeing change?
So we're moving from community planning to community action. This is the year of implementation, and you've probably heard me reference this in the media quite frequently. And we're looking to start servicing individuals and being able to touch families by fourth quarter of this year. And when you look at other models across the country and you look at any systems change effort, minimally it takes 7 years. On average, it takes 13 years. So when you look at Union City, New Jersey, and what they did around education, when you look at Cincinnati and Kentucky and what they did as it relates to collective impact, it's taken them at least 10, 13 years, and even Great Britain, for them to receive some of the results, even though that's a different, it's not necessarily apples to apples. So we should not expect to see outcomes in a year. But we could start to see process indicators and proximal measures that we can say that we're trending in the right direction. So Henry and his team is going to help us with the evaluation, and we're going to be able to determine if indeed we're moving in the right direction, and we're looking to launch our implementation efforts fourth quarter of this year. And then by the time we are able to engage adults in training programs and being able to employ individuals that may not necessarily have those employment opportunities and helping them to retain employment, the goal from that point is to come up with an evaluation plan by which we're working with Henry. And I said we want to start looking at, 6 months after the intervention for course corrections, but we're going to be looking at evaluating or assessing the effectiveness as a continuous quality improvement part of the evaluation on an ongoing basis. So probably every 30 days is going to be some type of interval, some type of looping to see exactly what we're doing and if we're doing it effectively.
Okay. And, I think of there was sort of a viral clip shared recently of Speaker of the House Paul Ryan talking about people in poverty and how Paul Ryan said, I was wrong. I, for years, talked about makers and takers, almost dichotomizing people who work, people in leadership positions, and then people who are in poverty as not wanting to work, wanting to just take resources, being lazy, et cetera. And Paul Ryan, interestingly enough, said, I was wrong about that. I'd like to hear from Dr. Brock and from LaShonda about, since this process started, collecting information, really analyzing poverty in Rochester, what is one big misconception you think people have about poverty?
Simply that people in poverty are lazy. People in poverty are not lazy. And then you cannot generalize and say that everyone in poverty doesn't want to work or doesn't want to go to school or they're not motivated or they don't demonstrate personal responsibility. Because ironically, when you look at the data, and Henry can actually speak to this, within the catchment neighborhood, we have 23,000 people within the three neighborhoods that we're targeting. Market View is not necessarily part of Connected Communities, but it's part of the anti-poverty catchment neighborhoods. So you have 23,000 people, you have 1,000 persons with post-secondary credentials. So not only do you have persons with post-secondary credentials, there's this other term that we use quite frequently in the community called working poor. These are individuals that are going to work and still living below the poverty threshold. So if you have, and then when you looked at that, we did a demographic profile at the beginning of the initiative. And what we were able to find is that, half, and again, there's ways that we have to still be able to dissect that data or disaggregate, half the working poor, as we classify as working part-time, full-time, or part-year, didn't have children. 25% had a post-secondary credential, and this is the working poor, which means they're working. So what are we doing as it relates to the 25% of the quote unquote working poor that is doing everything that we said you need to do to get out of poverty by having a job, getting an education that doesn't necessarily serve true? So there's 1,000 persons in the catchment neighborhood specifically, and we know that those are graduates, and there are 430 plus like MCC students that are currently in school in that neighborhood. So we have to think differently. We have to lead with the numbers. We have to lead with the data.
That data line up with what you've seen, Henry?
Absolutely. Yeah, I did a lot of that analysis to support that work. I think another key stat that really shocked a lot of people was just the amount, the very low amount of jobs being held in these neighborhoods. Right. Even of the people who are employed, less than 5% of them are able to find a job in their neighborhood. Over 50% of them are forced to commute out to employment outside of the city borders, out in the suburbs. So it reinforces the barrier of transportation. Certainly our public transit system doesn't work well. It's not always convenient for some of these service jobs and off-peak type employment opportunities. And it also reinforces the need to bring and create employment opportunities in these neighborhoods that are going to be accessible and walkable for people who might not have a car.
Sure. And LaShonda, what would you say you have seen as a misconception that people have about people living in poverty?
Absolutely. I think even as we speak to getting out of poverty and being at the table and really speaking to the solutions of poverty, people who are not at the table are not necessarily not interested in making a contribution. But if I think about individuals who are worried about getting their basic needs met, I'm not at a neighborhood association meeting. That doesn't mean that I don't care about the neighborhood. And it also, I think, speaks to the work that Connected Communities is trying to do in terms of ensuring that people can live, work, and play. Those barriers that Henry just spoke to, those are real barriers. And in Rochester, it's very, very difficult for you to be on one side of town with your child care, on another side of town with a child going to school, then going to work outside of the city, et cetera. So there are a lot of complicated issues that need to be addressed. And it doesn't mean that individuals aren't striving to address them. And some people are addressing one at a time, and then other barriers pop up, which prevents them from being able to get out of this cycle. And we see it generationally.
Okay, well, we're going to take the only break of the hour, and we're going to come back here. And if you're just joining us, not only are we talking about the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, but we're talking about the way they are connecting their work among agencies, among neighborhoods, and we're talking about their March report on guidelines, essentially the guidelines that they have put together after about a year of research and work groups to help guide the work going forward. And those, there's three of them, dealing with structural racism, trauma, and building communities. And what exactly do they mean by some of those things? When we come back, we're going to talk about that with Dr. Leonard Brock, director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, Henry Fitz, the director of innovation for the City of Rochester's I-Team, and LaShonda Leslie Smith, executive director at Connected Communities. Coming up in our second hour, from small films, 5-minute local films, to huge productions like Amazing Spider-Man 2, Rochester is quite the movie town, and New York State tax breaks and subsidies are a big part of the lure for at least some of the productions. Next hour, we look at the filmmaking landscape. What's a good deal for taxpayers? What should we be rooting for in movie making here? Join the conversation next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. LaShonda Leslie Smith, the executive director at Connected Communities, listened to the phone call of a listener named Terry, who called in and said, you know, I want to be a part of our community and these efforts, but sometimes I don't feel connected to what's going on. You know, if I come home from work and I want to know, you know, what's happening here, is there sort of a social media site? Is there a way to stay connected? And Leonard had a chance to talk about some of that, but I know you wanted to respond to Terry as well there.
Go ahead, LaShonda. Yes, absolutely. Connected Communities is in the process of working on its website. In the meantime, any individuals living in the Beechwood or the Emma neighborhood who wants to be brought up to date on what's happening in that community, Connected Communities serving as that community convener, would be happy to talk with them and inform them and keep them up to date. They can reach us at our office at 224-1075. Love for Terry to give me a call and we can sit down and have a chat.
And I know Henry wanted to weigh in as well about programs going forward, because obviously, you know, you're collecting data, but then you're deciding where can we apply, what, how can we monitor? Tell me about that.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think from the start, it's been the mayor's vision to start small, to choose a pilot geography in which we can really attack a multifaceted issue like poverty in all of its facets, but at a small enough scale that we're not going too big too fast, and that we can learn from our successes and failures, mm-hmm. and then eventually scale up. So to support and in partnership with our MAPI, to support and focus our efforts, we completed a data-driven selection process to look for a neighborhood in which we should start and a neighborhood that might be positioned for some success. So we compiled hundreds of variables from census data and city source data, other sources of data at a census tract level, and distilled down to 7 positive and 4 negative indicators, essentially looking for a neighborhood that both has serious socioeconomic issues like poverty and joblessness and crime, but also has some indicators of success, like it's had recent investment, there are services nearby, it's served by public transit fairly well. And the analogy we like to use is the biggest fire next to the most water. It's a neighborhood that maybe with a little more coordination, a little more investment, is poised to have start seeing some success. So the analysis pointed us towards the Market View and Beechwood and Emma area as the area that has that. And besides the story of the data, it also benefits from having very strong grassroots neighborhood groups in the Market View Heights Collective Action Project, the Beechwood and Emma neighborhoods, as well as the Bensonhurst neighborhoods, which are all very involved and active.
All right, so Henry, biggest fire next to the most water. It's a very interesting analogy, but the most water, I assume, means, you know, maybe maybe more neighbor involvement, maybe better access to transportation, public transportation, maybe a little bit more job opportunity. I don't know. What are some of the, what's the most water next to the most fire?
Sure. In that analogy, water, we're referring to services like existing nonprofits and programs, city facilities, and transportation access. So, you know, services that potentially are serving people in poverty who are trying to gain economic mobility and employment. So there are some of that already there, located in proximity to these neighborhoods.
And then as you start to coordinate even more and zero in on these neighborhoods and try to alleviate some of the joblessness and reduce the crime, et cetera, because you're starting small, as you said, the mayor's vision, think small, understand, really kind of get granular, don't go too big too fast. Will you, in contrast to Dr. Brock's point that a lot of these things take 10 years, sometimes 7, 10, 13 years, can you start looking a little sooner for a response in terms of efficacy?
Absolutely. And I think we have to. I think we have to set both short-term and long-term goals. And specifically when we're looking at the programs we're going to be launching, ensuring that we're building them around really strong data systems and evaluation systems that allow us to do continuous process improvement to track and measure things on the fly and make improvements, and that we can show short-term progress and be able to build success, build momentum, and that also helps us set us up. If we can demonstrate that we're having an impact at a very scientific level, that we're saving potentially the county and the state big sources of money, we can really set up these programs to be sustainable and scalable because of new types of financing mechanisms like social impact bonds, which look for that kind of rigor and that kind of return on investment analysis to fund and scale up small projects.
Okay, Dr. Brock?
Yes, and just as a point of clarity or clarification, it's not necessarily that it's counter to what I said prior, but we can see programmatic successes. But as it relates to population change,
sure,
being able to move,
absolutely,
that's going to take time.
But you're not going to see the poverty rate in Rochester. You know, half the kids or more growing up in poverty, a high rate of extreme poverty, which is living at less than half or less of the poverty line. You're not going to change that in a year or two or three,
right? And that's the point I was making as it relates to population shift. But the programmatic changes or the programmatic successes and the outcomes that we could achieve, we know that those are things that we can track and we can see. There has to be short-term and long-term goals. But I will also want to make another point, too, is the reason why the principles are so very important from a values-based perspective is because we're program rich and results poor. What makes it different is the coordination, the alignment, and being able to look at the efficacy of programs because we can't program our way out of poverty. And what makes this different is the stickiness that we're calling the guiding principles. And also to LaShonda's point earlier when she made reference to a person in poverty having to go across the entire community, one of the initial areas of priority for the anti-poverty initiative is to create a comprehensive system of social supports. So a person can have, and again, Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli talks about this this no wrong door approach where you go into a facility and all your needs could be met. And this can also look like a community school. So there's the micro aspect of it, but then there's the macro, being able to coordinate and align human services with education and health, but there's also doing it at the neighborhood level. And when IBM came to Rochester a few months ago, they talked about having a person-centered approach. So the focus is not on what programs we could support, but what are the needs of the individual and how we could remove the barriers that they need to be removed in order for them to be economically self-sufficient.
Have you had a chance to talk to RTS, people who are involved in public transportation, because if, as we've been finding out here, if you live in a neighborhood where only 5% of the working people can work in that neighborhood, so even if you want a job, you can't work there. You got to get to work. And if you're poor and you don't have a car, you know, are we doing a better job? Are we going to do a better job of providing that opportunity?
It's all on the table. We've actually had a series of conversations with RTS, and the good thing is we have Miguel, who's actually at this. He's part of the steering committee for the Rochester Memorial Anti-Poverty Initiative, and former County Executive Maggie Brooks, she's looking to engage as well. And I know Henry has been in contact with a number of persons within RTS as we talk about the adult mentoring or adult navigating strategy that we're looking to roll out. And
you want to hit that, Henry? Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, and I'll mention, you know, we now have monthly meetings with RTS to look at this transportation issue, and together we're actually going to be designing a transportation initiative for this geography as well. Looking at a van pool pilot to link employment opportunities out in the suburbs that are not well served by existing system to neighborhood residents who may be seeking those job opportunities. And potentially, you know, 8 to 10 people could take a van together out to work at a facility out in Greece and then come back and park it there in the neighborhood. And that will be their experience. And actually, the survey data that we just completed shows that, you know, over 80%, you know, around 80% of people think that they would take advantage of an opportunity like that.
Okay. So not only is it something that you think is viable, that it's coming, but people want it and will use it if it's there. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that could roll out as soon as when, Henry?
We're looking to launch that with the rest of the programming, which we're slated to look in September timeframe.
Okay. Let me grab Robert and Fairport, and then I want to get back to some of these guiding, sort of these guidelines that are helping shape the work of this initiative. But this is Robert and Fairport next up. Go ahead, Robert.
Thank you. One of the biggest demographic differences between the city of Rochester and the suburbs is the out-of-wedlock birth rate. The rate in the city of Rochester is about 2 to 3 times that of the suburbs. Is this effort ever going to focus on trying to narrow that difference?
Robert, thanks very much. Dr. Brock, you want to start there?
So there's, and interestingly enough, Rochester, and again, that's not necessarily speaking to this question directly, but I will. Teenage pregnancy prevention is actually something that we are touting as something that we've been able to reduce the last several years. It is something that we would indirectly be able to address, because when you look at early childhood supports and creating those opportunities for young people in particular, so look at early childhood supports, and 85% of a young person's brain development take place within the first 5 years of life, and that's their cognitive function and executive functioning. And if we are able to create a pathway or a pipeline that will allow young people to be able to exercise you know, the importance of again, this is higher education, opportunities for them to engage in the workforce where they don't have the same barriers that the parents may have, they are able to make different decisions primarily than some of the other, you know, families by which we have that as an issue that we need to overcome. So the goal is for us to be preventative. More so preventative than reactive. So a prevention strategy is the work that we're doing with early child support around home visitation. And again, this is working with parents, first-time mothers. Again, being able to focus on early childhood supports like early education and being able to develop a young person so when the time comes for them to be able to be to engage in higher education, they would be able to, they would look at those decisions from a different vantage point.
I mean, I'd also say there's a bit of a chicken and egg part of this question from Robert, which is really well-intended, I mean, but it's the same kind of question with schools. You know, do you need to fix schools to fix poverty? Or if you fix poverty, you almost inherently, schools will be better. I mean, we know that. Robert, if we reduced poverty by half, you would see the teen pregnancy rate fall. We know that.
So this is an interesting conversation. I know I didn't necessarily answer the question directly, but and again, this is putting myself out there to some extent, and I'm actually going to do the same thing for LaShonda if it's okay. You're looking at two teenage parents. I'm a director, I have a PhD, you know, I have a doctorate. LaShonda is very successful. And I don't want to say that's a deterrent. Now, we know that there's work to be done, but that doesn't mean that that's a person's life sentence because they are a teenage parent or that's the reason why they have to be a person that have to experience poverty for the rest of their life. You have two teenage parents actually conducting this interview. And again, I'm not trying to, and I looked at you to see if it was okay for me to share that.
My life's,
I know you
an
said
open
it publicly.
Book. Literally.
And there was a book actually that you wrote that kind of speaks to this. But that's not to give an excuse. I'm just saying in general, I don't want that to be the life sentence that we're placing on young people if they do have experience.
It's also fair to say you two are more the exception than the rule. You know, that if you have a child, if you're living, especially if you grow up in poverty and then you become a teen parent, it's going to be that much harder.
I also think that's one of the reasons why we're leaders in these types of initiatives, because we have been at the table, literally, on both sides of the receiving of the services as well as the delivering of the services. So being able to talk to and speak to from a very personal place what the barriers actually are. Yep. There were lots and lots of barriers, and some people give up, and it just seems easier to go with the status quo. But if there are resources that that will help to eliminate those barriers to address poverty, and then really speaking to systemic racism and all of these other things that are so huge. And it's not just about what my parents did when I was growing up, but it really is a systemic and multifaceted issue. When we're able to address those things, that's when we'll be able to see the needle moved.
All right. Sure. And I think I'm correct in this, and our producer Megan Mack will come tell me if I'm wrong. I think the teen pregnancy and teen parenthood rate in this country, nationwide, is lower than it has been in many years.
It is dropping.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep. So certainly in impoverished communities, that is going to be higher. And Robert's right. That's what we're looking at in Rochester. But I think reducing poverty in general is going to almost inherently ensure that that rate will fall ever more. So not to say that there's not an impetus to try to work before poverty falls, to say right now, let's try to cut teen pregnancy, no doubt about it. But those things are pretty closely locked there. I just want to ask a little bit about, and we've got 10 minutes left. I couldn't possibly get through all I would like to ask about this March report, this March set of guidelines that came out. But I'll remind our listeners again, if you follow Megan and me on Twitter, you will find a link to this report that I call it a report. I mean, it's a set of guidelines that came out in March, and it's there. And there are three main sort of guidelines that will help guide the Anti-Poverty Initiative going forward, that if you missed it earlier, Dr. Brock was saying in their research, in their work groups, these kept coming up. And that is trauma, structural racism, and community building. And interestingly enough, within each of those three, you've got 15 points on how to deal with them. So let me just give you an example, and then I kind of want to talk about it. Here's structural racism. 15 points on dealing with structural racism. Number one, allow people to reach their full potential. Number two, provide equitable opportunities. Number three, act, taking action to correct or respond to discrimination. Number four, reflect diversity by intentionally building leadership at all levels that reflects the racial diversity of the population served. Number five, be responsive to needs. Number six, engage communities. Number seven, use data and evidence-based practices. Number eight, customize services for individuals and communities. Nine, create dialogue. 10, reflect community diversity. And I'm going to come back to that in a second. Number 11, take responsibility. Number 12, be willing to push yourself. Number 3, be diligent. 14, do your best. And 15, keep learning. Now, listen, some of that stuff is kind of nebulous, but that some of that stuff's pretty specific. And I want to address two of the points. Number 4 is reflect diversity by intentionally building leadership at all levels that reflects the racial diversity of the population served. Number 10 is reflect community diversity. Kind of goes hand in hand. And it says, we will ensure that governance structures, boards of directors, and other leadership bodies reflect the diversity of the communities being served. Dr. Brock, that means eventually hoping that boards of organizations, that government, so government agencies, that probably elected government bodies, if we can do that, classrooms, teaching bodies, reflect community diversity.
Right.
Tell me why, first of all, that's a goal.
Right. Well, equity and diversity, clearly, there's huge benefits to it. And there's a huge return in the investment of being able to diversify workforces and different bodies of leadership. But before, I want to back out of that question real quick. And we're following a collective impact model. We talk about having a shared goal. One of the initial, I guess, areas of collective impact is having a shared goal or shared values. In order for you to have mutually reinforcing activities and practices that respond to that shared goal and a shared value, we can all say we want to reduce poverty. And that means so many different things to so many different people. These guiding principles become those shared values by which we're looking to align and be able to coordinate those mutually reinforcing activities and practices. The reason why equity is important, and again, I can speak to it from so many different angles, but I'm just going to speak to what came out of the work group process and, again, the information that was shared from people that were impacted by poverty and the institutional leaders that said it's something that they would like to do, is because there's a disconnect in our community. In addition to there being programs and not necessarily the results that follow, you know, the mayor had talked about it being a tale of two cities. And you often hear that there aren't enough people that are qualified. But some odd reason, there's a significant number. I'm actually keynoting a graduation today, and there's going to be a significant number of people of color graduating with their master's degrees. And those persons oftentimes have a very challenging time finding sustainable employment. So if you have these graduates and then you have employers that says, you know, there's not necessarily a qualified candidate pool, same thing that even happens within the catchment neighborhood with 1,000 people have a post-secondary credential. The goal is, how do we be able to create that bridge or serve as a broker so everyone is afforded not only the opportunity to these opportunities that exist, but for employers or even for nonprofit boards so they can reflect that diversity of thought that will allow for us to be able to move forward and accelerate in the 21st century. We can't continue to engage in the same practices that have allowed us to be where we are today. And the only way that we can reflect that diversity and be able to have that difference of thought at the table is to ensure that equity is practiced at every single level of leadership.
And that means being overt about it, mm-hmm. talking about it, saying that it is a goal to be, you know, reflected in the boardroom, in right. the leadership levels. Because, Leonard, you're going to run into people who say, but hey, if the most qualified dozen people for a dozen spots all happen to be white, those should be the people, you know, even if that doesn't reflect the community diversity. You hear that all the time.
You hear it all the time because, again, it speaks to the disconnect. There are qualified candidates of color. But if you are relying on a natural network, that's why this is important for us to have this conversation and be able to address it from a way that's very deliberate. Because if I'm relying on my natural network is going to reflect my lived experience, is going to reflect my social interactions and the people I talk to on a regular basis. It may not necessarily be like that of my other cultural ethnic counterparts. So it's an opportunity for us to bring everyone, at least have everyone have the same conversation. Everyone is already starting to come to the table, but the goal is, what are we looking to do differently as it relates to responding to opportunities by which everyone could work together? So yes, you're going to hear that, but again, that's one of those myths that we need to demystify, mm-hmm. is that you don't have qualified candidates. Because I could, you know, there was a retired reporter from City Magazine that interviewed me some years ago, and I had the same conversation, and he asked me to write a list. I was able to write 20 plus people that were either underemployed or unemployed, and they all were very skilled. Several had to leave Rochester, mm-hmm. and they're doing extremely well in other communities. So that's part of the brain drain too, is because we're not doing a really good job of engaging leaders of color.
Well, I think, LaShonda, what would you say the message is for people in a community when the higher up you go in organizations, whether it's not-for-profits, government, for-profit companies, that even if there's diversity at the lower levels of the workforce, the higher up you go, it becomes more racially monolithic. What is the message to people, especially people trying to get out of poverty?
The message is, you're not important, you're not qualified, you're not equal. And I think to speak to Dr. Brock's point, when you're not intentional, when it's not measured, it's not going to happen. So we can all have very good ideas. We can feel fuzzy on the inside about really eliminating poverty and addressing racism. But unless we're very, very specific about that and come up with measurable practices to implement at every level and get partners to sign on. I love that the RMAPI has this community sign up. And I think it needs to go even beyond that. It really has to be in the values at various organizations. It has to be in the training, the onboarding, so that as people are moving up the ladder, there's a cultural shift within those organizations that allow people of ethnic descent to access those needed opportunities. And not just at the employment level, but at the leadership level. When we look at nonprofit boards across Rochester, the majority of these individuals are not reflective of the population that those organizations are serving. And so we need to take a look at that and address it as well.
Well, I think every board, whether you're WXXI or United Way or whatever it is, I think it's a valuable goal, and I understand it. And again, if you want to read more about these, I mean, again, I just went through structural racism, and we're about to be out of time. You want to read more about thoughts on trauma and addressing that and why it's a value? It's there. You want to read more about what they mean by building communities? It's there in these March guidelines, which, again, we've linked to. Some final thoughts, Dr. Brock, here. We're down to about our last minute here. And I just, you know, want to know where you see the next steps. What's happening right now that you want the community to know about?
We're focusing on implementation. So we're putting together the plan so we can specifically be able to roll out projects fourth quarter. So there's not going to be a hiatus. We're going to continue to engage the community and keep the community informed. We've got the Community Advisory Council. We're going to continue to mobilize and get people to actually sign on to the principles and create that movement. But we're also focused on implementation. And the good thing is we have great partners around the community. And again, we have partners like the Regional Economic Development Council that supports what we're doing with the principles. We have our institutional leaders that supports what we're doing with those principles. So there's a unique opportunity, an opportunity of a lifetime to do some things very differently as it relates to shifting the culture. So I'm excited.
And Terry had a caller named Terry had asked earlier, I want to stay involved. Listen, I want to learn more. You mentioned a website. What's the website?
EndingPovertyNow.org.
EndingPovertyNow.org. I hope you continue to check in with us and keep us informed. Dr. Leonard Brock, director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. As always, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And Henry Fitz, director of innovation for City of Rochester's I-Team. A lot of work ahead, but I know that they appreciate it, and we appreciate your time as well, Henry.
Thank you.
And LaShonda Leslie-Smith, executive director at Connected Communities. Thank you as well for your time.
Thank you.
All right, short break. More connections next.